This morning, at the end of our time, we're going to be gathering around the Lord's table, taking bread and the cup. And if you know and love the Lord Jesus Christ, then you are welcome to join us around that table. As we do so, as we take the bread and cup, as we do this in remembrance of Jesus, we are always brought face to face with the reality of sacrifice in the life of Christ. I don't think there's any coincidence in the fact that our Bible passage this morning also has a strong emphasis on sacrifice. Though I am free and belong to no one, I make myself a slave to everyone. If there's one big lesson that we as a fellowship need to hear loud and clear in our self-centered culture, and in a church which can sometimes be very comfortable, I think it is this: the Christian life is cross-shaped. Sacrifice, one of the big themes this morning. But I think there's two other big lessons that we as a church and as individuals need to take away from this table and also from this passage this morning. The first is simply this: that the sacrifice of Jesus was something that he did for the salvation of others. This is my body given for you. Jesus was on a mission intent on saving people. And we see again the same in our passage this morning. He says, verse 19, though I am free and belong to no one, I make myself a slave of everyone. Why? To win as many as possible. And I wonder whether we've lost that desire at Grove Hill, a desire to see people won for Jesus. So at this table and at this passage, as they come together this morning, I believe that again the Lord is putting his finger on an issue for Grove Hill. We need to become deliberately missional, deliberately evangelistic, reaching out to seek and to save that which is lost. And I stress that word deliberately missional because, again, it is something that we are reminded of here in these elements and also in our Bible passage this morning. And we read in the Gospels that Jesus set his face like a flint to Jerusalem. He knew what he was about. He knew where he was going and why he was going and what he was doing. There was something very purposeful about Jesus, and that purposeful attitude is also picked up in our passage this morning. That familiar little phrase at the end, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. As Christ set his face to Jerusalem, so the apostle of Christ, the apostle Paul, is running to get the prize. He was purposeful in his life. I don't think there's any coincidence that the Lord has brought this chapter, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, and this table together this morning to teach us these very simple truths. True spirituality is sacrificial, it is missional, and it is purposeful. It is sacrificial, it is missional, and it is purposeful. So we've given this morning's message simply this title, The Believer Who Means Business. The Believer Who Means Business. A few Christmases back, Andre gave me a book called Onward, and it was written by Howard Schultz, the man who started Starbucks, the coffee chain. Andre said it was meant to teach me something about leadership, but I think it was probably more to do with the fact that he wanted to improve the quality of the church's coffee. However, having been involved in business myself in the past, I enjoyed some of the book and the stories about the ups and downs of this famous enterprise. Many of you know Starbucks started in Seattle, Northwest USA, and became a global enterprise. And at some point in the past, Howard Schultz handed the company over to a team of executives. But when he and others felt that the business was kind of losing its way, he decided to step back into the hot spot again. That's really what the book is all about. And it was quite a thing to do. Here was a man whose whole life was dedicated to this brand. And it's very impressive as you read about his commitment. But you know, from time to time, as I read the book, I realized how really insignificant things became really big in this guy's mind and so important to the team he was working with. And one of the things that struck me, I remember reading it in bed actually, and I said to Corey, I've just read two pages all about breakfast sandwiches and the importance of breakfast sandwiches. He says this, for me, the most acute example of how Starbucks was deviating from its heritage and losing its magic was the breakfast sandwich. I could not stand it. The breakfast sandwich became my quintessential example of how we were losing our way. Get the sandwiches out, he said. Look, the point is this, isn't it? Here is a man who really meant business. He's always thinking about how things could be improved, what needed to change, what strategy they had to adopt, and it was all to sell coffee. Now, what we're being asked this morning is to mean business, to be purposeful, to be strategic, to get engaged in order what? To win people for Christ, for eternity, so that Jesus might be raised high, in order that we might do what we were made for, to enjoy God and enjoy Him forever. So as I say, to begin with, that will involve some sacrifice. Some sacrifice. Let's put that up there. True spirituality is firstly sacrificial. Now last week we were in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. And you may remember that we tried to sum up the message of 1 Corinthians 8, chapter 8 in a certain way. We're going to put that up on the screen. We had this phrase in chapter 8. Our knowledge and freedom as believer, or our rights, take second place behind our love for others and our desire for their spiritual good. So that was the kind of the summary sentence from 1 Corinthians chapter 8 last Sunday. Our knowledge and freedom as believers, or our rights, take second place behind our love for others and our desire for their spiritual good. Now I just want you to have that lesson in your mind. And let's just read through the first half of chapter 9 again. And as we do so, I want you to note how often the apostle speaks about his freedoms, his rights, and what he does with them. Okay, so let's just turn in our Bibles. If you've got your Bible there, page 1150, 1 Corinthians chapter 9. Let's just read that first half of the chapter again. With that in mind, note how Paul refers to his rights, his freedoms, and then what he does with them. Verse 1. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are you not the result of my work in the Lord? Even though I may not be an apostle to others, surely I am to you. For you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. He had planted the church in Corinth. That's the point he's making. This is my defense to those who sit in judgment on me. Don't we have the right to food and drink? Don't we have the right to take a believing wife along with us, as do the other apostles and the Lord's brothers and Cephas? Is it only I and Barnabas who must work for a living? Then he comes up with some arguments from daily life. Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard and does not eat of its grapes? Who tends a flock and does not drink of the milk? Do I say this merely from a human point of view? He's going to go to the Bible now. Doesn't the law say the same thing? For it is written, in the Old Testament that is, in the law of Moses, do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain. Is it about oxen that God is concerned? Surely he says this for us, doesn't he? Yes, this was written for us, because when the ploughman ploughs and the thresher threshes, they ought to do so in hope of sharing in the harvest. If we have sown spiritual seed among you, is it too much if we reap a material harvest from you? If others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? All the way from the very beginning of this chapter, he is explaining his rights to have support, financial, material support, from the church in Corinth. What does he then say? Second half of verse 12. But we did not use this right. On the contrary, we put up with anything. Why? Rather than hinder the gospel of Christ. Then he kind of comes at it again, verse 13. Don't you know that those who work in the temple get their food from the temple? Those who serve at the altar share in what is offered at the altar. In the same way, the Lord has commanded those who preach the gospel should receive their living from the gospel. Again, he's explaining his rights to receive income from them. Verse 15, but I have not used any of these rights. Now you see, I wonder whether we can see why Paul's talking about this. Although there are some important lessons in this passage about why God's servants should be properly paid, lessons that people like me are very grateful for, and I'm sure you can understand, it seems rather strange thing for Paul to start talking about when he's just been answering questions about eating food sacrificed for idols and believers not putting their freedoms before the good of others. Until you realize that actually he's developing that theme and he's giving himself as an example. He's not just talking the talk, he's also walking the walk. They insisted on their rights ahead of the good of others. And he says, I want to show you how I've taken a completely different track. I had all sorts of rights. I could have forced myself on you. But I've not insisted on my rights. I did not use my rights. It is so countercultural in our society today. We have a Bill of Rights in certain parts of the world. We have institutional human rights. We have customers' charters. You are entitled to this. Think about how many of your conversations with your friends involve them explaining to you how they had certain rights and certain people should have behaved in a different way to them because of their rights and so on and who they are. Think about how much that bothers you from time to time. But here we have Christ the apostle. We might put it like this. He was bang to rights. But he did not use his rights. Rather, he put up with anything instead of hindering the gospel of God. Now what this is saying to us this morning is that we as believers march to the sound of a different drum from our society. We march to the sound of a hammer on a nail. We march to the sound of sacrifice. And we're reminded of that as we come to this table. And we're reminded of that as we come to this passage. Let's put that up again. Thanks, Rob. True spirituality is sacrificial. So that if you have found that living as a Christian seems to always require you doing things for others, going out of your way, putting up with something that you'd rather avoid, then this passage should at least reassure you that that is normal. That is true spirituality. But more than this, it should also encourage you to recognize that in your sacrifice for others, you are simply reflecting the family likeness of Jesus. At the end of this section in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 1, kind of brings you to the end of this section. The apostle ends by saying this, "Follow my example as I follow the example of Christ." Everything that he said about giving up his rights, he says it's simply because I'm following the example of Christ. Sacrifice is part of the family likeness. But secondly, so is mission. True spirituality is sacrificial, but it's also missional. Why does the Apostle Paul make himself a slave to everyone? Answer, to win as many as possible. True spirituality is missional. And we see what that looks like in practice. So just turn back to the passage and see where he goes. Look at verse 20 and following. Start at verse 19. Though I am free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. What does that actually look like in reality for the Apostle Paul? He tells us, verse 20 and following. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law. so as to win those under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I'm not free from God's law, but under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. To the weak, I became weak to win the weak. I have become all things to all men, so that by all possible means I might save some. Now, three or four different groups of people are referred to there in that little list of categories. The Jews, those under the law, possibly another reference to Jews or maybe to God-fearers, Gentiles who had associated themselves with Jews and put themselves under Jewish law, those not having the law, specifically to Gentiles, and then the weak, taking us back to chapter 8 and referring to those who were overtly bound up with idolatry. And in each case, Paul, in his desire to reach them, is after them, accommodating himself to them in one way or another. Just note this morning. None of these people that Paul refers to here are his type of people. None of them are his type of people. Even though he was a Jew, he's not like these Jews anymore because of his faith in Jesus. None were his type, but he accommodates himself to them. He gets alongside them in order to win them for Christ. Now, I came across this quote. We're going to put it up on the screen this morning. I found it very helpful. I think it's something that we need to reflect on. The great principle of biblical evangelism is the building of bridges to people where they are, not the expectation for them to build bridges to us. I wonder whether you see that's the spirit of the Apostle Paul here. To the Jew I became a Jew, to those under the law I became, to those without law I became, to the weak I became. He's building the bridges to them, not expecting them to build the bridges to him. Now, I realize that this may take all sorts of different forms in its application for us today. But we have to start with this question. Ask it of yourself. How can I get alongside people for the sake of the gospel? Just ask that question. How can I get alongside people for the sake of the gospel? How can I get into relationship with folk? Folk who are completely outside of the circle of the church, beyond the fringe. How can I get alongside them in such a way that they can get to know me a bit, where we can have meaningful conversations, possibly over a long period of time, which start to go below the surface, beyond the weather, beyond the football, beyond talk of our holidays. And I think for many of us that will be the workplace, taking full advantage of the opportunities that we have in the workplace. Just being willing to socialize a bit with folk in the workplace, possibly seeing them at times outside of working hours. Looking for times when you can be perhaps one-to-one with folk. People very rarely open up and honest with you if other people are there as well. You need to seek an opportunity with people that you work alongside to see them outside of work very often or lunch break, getting into a one-to-one situation. For others of us, I think it means making full advantage of our neighbourhood friendships, opening our homes to people who live in our road, taking time to chat with people, but again being missional, seeking to get into a position where you're one-to-one with somebody or couple-to-couple with people in your road, creating a space where people feel confident to be open to you, where you might be able to share something about God's love in Christ, where you might be missional in your dealings with them. And beyond that, I think we need to realize the opportunities that belonging to clubs and societies and being in adult education classes, they again give us opportunities to connect with folk, build relationships with them. They can be our mission field. The golf club, the adult education class, the choir, whatever it is I belong to, that can become my mission field. Places where, again, I can develop a rapport with people, understand folk, their hopes and their dreams and their fears. Where I can point out some of the weakness and frailty of human condition and point them to the solid rock of Christ. And finally, I think that voluntary groups provide some great opportunities for us to get alongside folk. You see the same folk regularly across the year. You get to know them. They see that you're diligent, generous with your time. And particularly for men, it gives you an opportunity when you're working with others to have those so-called sideways conversations. Think about serving in a charity shop, helping out at a school or at a library, just getting involved in some kind of project that's going on in the neighbourhood. Meeting people who are outside, building bridges to them, rather than expecting them to build bridges to us. Now you might say, but the people there are not my type. They don't have the same morals as I do, the same upbringing and background. None of the people Paul refers to reaching here are his type of people. Some of them probably grated on him terribly, but he gets alongside them. He sacrifices some things in order to save some. I wonder whether that actually appeals to you as I just kind of describe some of those possible scenarios. I wonder whether that appeals to you. I wonder whether it kind of gets your juices going. The idea of reaching people beyond the fringe of the fellowship. I wonder whether that's actually a sign that something of this true spirituality is in you. That the wind of the Spirit is in your sails, the Spirit of Christ. I wonder whether it's proof that you're finding yourself marching to his drumbeat this morning. But friends, if the idea of leaving your comfortable corner and going out of your way to build relationships with folk for the gospel's sake, if that is immediately dismissed, even seen as ugly and off-putting, then can I just say, honestly, sincerely, just do the logic in your mind. Just do the maths, as we sometimes say. Be honest with yourself this morning. Is there any echo of Christ's heart in you? Is there any echo from this table? As you share in the cup, as you share in the bread, as you remember the one whose body was broken so that those who were far off could be brought near, can't you catch something of that love for others yourself? Can't you catch something of that sacrifice, that missional heart that we see here? True spirituality is sacrificial and it's missional. And then lastly, finally, it's purposeful. Just look at Paul's purpose in the last paragraph. Take it from verse 24. Do you not know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one gets the prize? Run in such a way as to get the prize. Everyone who competes in the games goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown that will not last, but we do it to get a crown that will last forever. Therefore, I do not run like a man running aimlessly. I do not fight like a man beating the air. No, I beat my body and make it my slave so that after I preach to others, I myself will not be disqualified from the prize. Paul is looking forward to the prize, the welcome from his Lord who greets him with those words, "Well done, good and faithful servant." Do you want the Lord to welcome you in that way? Well done, Steve, Eric, Sue, Rita. Well done, good and faithful servant. Do you want your life to count for Christ? Now just consider a couple of stories. In April year 2000, Ruby Eliasson and Laura Edwards were killed in Cameroon, West Africa. Ruby, at the time, was over 80. Single all her life, she poured it out for one great thing: to make Jesus Christ known among the unreached, the poor, and the sick. Laura, her friend, was a widow, a medical doctor, also pushing 80 years old, and serving at Ruby's side in the Cameroon. The brakes of their car failed, It went over the cliff, and they were both killed instantly. Was that a tragedy? Two lives driven by one great passion, namely to be spent in unheralded service to the perishing poor for the glory of Jesus Christ. 20 years after most of their American counterparts had retired to throw away their lives on trifles. No, that was not a tragedy. That was a glory. These lives were not wasted. These lives were not lost. I will tell you what a tragedy is. I will show you how to waste your life. Consider a story from the February edition, 1998, of Reader's Digest, which tells about a couple who took early retirement from their jobs. He was 59, she was 51. Now they live in Florida, where they cruise on their 30-foot trawler and play softball and collect shells. At first, when I read it, I thought it was a joke, a spoof on the American dream, but it wasn't. Tragically, this was the dream. Come to the end of your life, your one and only precious life, one and only God-given life, and let the last great work of your life before you give an account to your Creator be this: playing softball and collecting shells. Picture them before Christ at the great day of judgment. Lord, it's great to see you. Come and see my shells. When we come to this table this morning, there's nothing wasteful about this. There's nothing aimless. There's nothing pointless about what Jesus did. His life had purpose. His sacrificial, missional life had purpose. And what this passage and what this table is saying to us this morning is, he offers the same to you. So look, as you take these elements in remembrance of him, as they kind of speak again to you of God's love for you through his Son Christ, what better response could there be for you to determine to speak that same message to others also? As they speak to you, why not be an echo of that to others around you? Because that's true spirituality. It is sacrificial. It is missional. It is purposeful. Anything else is a fake. We're going to pick up some of those thoughts in our song as we move to the table. It's in the blue book.